Well, Alistair very kindly said just then that he would entertain questions, and I'm sure there are some, so if you have some, please raise your hand and speak up.
Questions, please.
You began by praising Dawkins for the clarity of his argument. May I begin by saying I think you presented the opposite view with equal clarity and considerably more considerable. The problem I wanted to raise, though, is in the issue of God as an agent of evolution. That's okay, so long as you can believe in an imperfect and amoral God, because evolution is clearly quite amoral in its processes, and there are a great many imperfections in it, otherwise we wouldn't have an appendix. Can you
elaborate on that? Well, that's a very important point. The question basically was to do with if one does indeed believe in God and sees God as in any way involved in evolution, then isn't the imperfection of the present state of things actually quite a problem? And it's a very good question. And again, because this is such a big question, you'll appreciate I'm not going to be able to really give a full response in the time available. But certainly for Darwin, that was a very significant issue. I mean, Darwin obviously was deeply concerned by the death of his daughter and a whole range of other things. But there's no doubt that his disgust, actually, at some aspects of the biological world did lead him to raise some very important questions about whether about how God was involved in the evolutionary process. And certainly those evolutionists who are theists have recognized the importance of precisely the point that you have made. For example, I know Pierre Teilhard de Chardin does need to be critiqued at many points, but he certainly recognized the importance of that point and tried to argue that towards which evolution was progressing, when achieved, would allow us to look backwards and see the present-day unsatisfactions in a much more positive way. Now, personally, I'm not entirely happy about that. But certainly, I think what I'd want to say is that the whole issue of pain, apparent waste in evolution, raises precisely the issues which the issue of pain and suffering raises in general for a Christian understanding of God. And it is probably the most significant difficulty that any Christian writer would have to face. So I have to leave it there, but it's a very fair point to make right at the beginning of this. Thank you. Yes, let's take you, sir. Yes, please.
It seems to me that your engagement with Dawkins is trying to play in its own game and trying to point out some internal inconsistencies in some of his ideas. My question to you is, in this sort of apologetics that you're participating in, do you think there's any place for post-rational story about how we believe what we believe, how we know what we know?
That's a very interesting question. I will repeat it, if I may, because I'm sure this didn't carry backwards. The questioner began by making the point that what I was really doing was trying to raise some questions about the internal consistency of Dawkins' approach. But then you asked, is there some way that we can move beyond this to some post-rational way of, well, trying to make sense of things, I guess? And again, I think that is a very fair comment. And I think what I will do is try to indicate what I think Dawkins might say in response to your question and then give my own particular angle on it. I think that certainly what I was trying to do is simply say that Dawkins' arguments are not as straightforward as he makes them out to be. That really is the bottom line of everything I've been saying. And what I'm really saying is therefore we need to look at them in more detail. If this lecture starts that process, I'm very, very happy. But Dawkins himself is very, very strong on the importance of what he calls the path of direct, straightforward thinking. And he is very unhappy about some of the trends he sees in postmodern culture, which seem to him to represent an evasion of rationality. And he, for example, is, I think, if I may say so, unfairly critical of writers like Karl Popper and others who have just tried to raise some concerns about the limits of evidence-driven approaches to the world. But he sees these as potentially an attack on truth itself. The question that you raise for me is whether actually there are limits to scientific knowledge. And I don't know the answer to that, but certainly it's a very important question. Let me illustrate it again with reference to something that's absolutely central to what Dawkins wants to talk about. Dawkins basically sets out Darwinism not simply as a scientific hypothesis, but actually as a way of viewing the world. It's a worldview. And he argues it's far more universal, far more satisfying than some of the parochial worldviews offered by, for example, Karl Marx and others. Interestingly, at one point in The Devil's Chaplain, a very recent collection of essays, you will know, he makes the point that whilst Darwinism is currently the best way we have of making sense of things, it may not remain so. That actually, because evidence is, you know, it's limited to this space, this time we're in, it's going to change as time moves on, Darwinism actually may not be around in a recognizable form in 100 years' time. Now, I find that very interesting, because one of the criticisms I make of Dawkins in my book, but I hadn't time in this lecture, is that he doesn't really seem to engage with what's called radical theory change in science. In other words, for example, you know, we used to believe in phlogiston and things like that, but those have been left behind, and more recently, of course, the ether. You know, that's been left behind. What other things will be left behind as scientific advance proceeds? I don't think we can know, and that's why, again, I come back to this point about inference. That by its very nature, science is able to say something like this: at this moment in time, we believe that the best way of seeing things is this, but we recognize this may change as time moves on. So my question for Dawkins, really, given the certainty he seems to invest in the scientific enterprise, is, isn't this actually really raising questions about what the longer-term stability of some of the ideas he develops really are? Thank you. Let's go to this side. There's somebody here, I think. Yes, please, please. The questioner is asking about the idea or that there's a virus which kind of transmits God, but in particular, some recent theorizing that there is a gene which in some way causes you to believe in God, something like that? Yes. I have to say that I would be very, very skeptical of that. And again, Dawkins isn't here, but I think he would be very, very skeptical of that as well. He's absolutely clear. You know, that you cannot say there is a gene for homosexuality. You cannot say the gene for this. It's much more complex than that. And I think really I would want to say that the idea there's some genetic predisposition to believe in God, I think really is without evidential warrant. I can see how you could skew things to lead to that conclusion. But it does raise an enormous number of methodological questions. For example, how do you differentiate between different beliefs in God? Is it belief in general or belief in God that is being addressed in this way? I'm just very skeptical about these kind of approaches, I'm afraid. Thank you. Oh, this is the last question.
Is there any room for an evidence-based approach to special divine action?
Is there any is there any possibility or room for an evidence-based approach for special divine action? It partly will depend on what you and I mean by that rather elusive phrase, special divine action. In more general terms, I think that there is no doubt that I would want to argue that Christians who wish to defend their faith or wish to commend their faith really do need to use evidence-driven modes of argument. And I think that one of my concerns is that some Christians use a sort of God of the gaps approach. You know, we can't explain this, so therefore this is where God resides, something like that. For me, the much more interesting thing is the fact that the thing can be explained at all. And here, you know, I'm very much at one with John Polkinghorne, who makes the point very, very clearly from a physicist's point of view, that the very fact that we can understand things, or even better, represent them mathematically, is actually remarkable. Because if you think of it, mathematics is supposed to be the free creation of the human mind. But, you know, as Galileo pointed out all those years ago, when you start looking at the language of the universe, it seems to be written in the language of mathematics. So why is this correspondence? And certainly, Polkinghorne produces this very interesting argument that the Christian vision of creation is able to accommodate precisely that. So I would certainly want to say that faith is indeed about engaging with evidence, but being aware that there will come a point where actually you have to say the evidence takes you this far, but at some point you have to make a leap of faith. But I would want to say the atheist does precisely the same. That I think that's right, because basically the sciences lead to agnosticism. In other words, you cannot adjudicate this question by empirical means. Therefore, if you say there is a God, you are taking a leap of faith. If you're saying there is not a God, you're equally taking a leap of faith.